WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sting is starring in the new movie Gentlemen Don't Eat Poets, based on a story by Patrick McGraw. Sting's international tour ended last week, and tomorrow night he hosts Saturday Night Live. On this archive edition, we have an interview recorded with him last year after the release of his CD Mercury Falling. We talked about life before and after he became known as Sting. He grew up, Gordon Sumner, in Newcastle, England. In the late 70s, he was the lead vocalist and bass player of the British rock band The Police. Their hits included Roxanne and Every Breath You Take. Sting went on to a very successful solo career. He's also acted in the films Quadrophenia, Brimstone and Trickle, Stormy Monday, and The Adventures of Baron von Munchausen. And he played McHeath in a Broadway production of Threepenny Opera. Let's start with a song from Mercury Falling. This is I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying.
7 weeks have passed now since she left me. She shows her face to ask me how I am. She says the kids are fine, that they miss me. Maybe I could come and babysit sometime. She says, are you okay? I was worried about you. Can you forgive me? I hope that you'll be happy. I say, I'm so happy that I can't stop crying. I'm so happy I'm laughing through my tears.
Sting, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Tell us about the song we just heard, I'm So Happy I Can't Stop Crying, about how you wrote the lyric and the music for this one.
I actually wrote it as a different kind of song. It's kind of a rock song, really. And then I looked again at the lyrics and I realized, you know, it's about divorce and separation and it's a country song. So I changed the arrangement and I put two in the bar on the bass and I got a pedal steel player in and... I think there's a certain amount of irony about it being a country song, and yet it works. You know, I think the song is quite cynical in the beginning. He says, I'm so happy I can't stop crying, and he doesn't mean it. But I think by the end of the song, he's made some kind of journey of acceptance of the situation, or some kind of ability to face that situation, the courage to face the situation, and he actually means it by the end. So there's a journey being made, and... I like that song, actually.
I'd like to talk with you about your life and go back to your early days as a child. I know you grew up in Newcastle, England, an industrial town?
It's a seaport and various heavy industries. There's a coal field there, and it was an interesting town, though. It wasn't uninteresting. It certainly was. It was a Roman town. It was a medieval town. It was an industrial revolution town.
Was there much of... Much live music or any arts community there?
A huge music group there, mainly folk music and jazz. And every pub on every street corner has some kind of music going on in there. And that was the first sort of arena where I learned to play.
And how did you start singing?
How did I start singing? I always had a voice, actually. I would sing very sweetly in the choir at school. But when asked to sing on my own, it simply wasn't macho to be able to sing, so I would feign the voice of a crow, as all my peers did. But actually, when everybody was singing, I would have this angelic sort of voice. And I was aware that I could sing. I knew that I could sing. It was only when I began to play the guitar about the age of 8 or 9, and I think I began to sing about the age of 10.
Now, you went to Catholic school?
I did.
Did you ever go through a period of wanting to be a priest?
I did. I toyed with that idea, but rather perversely, I thought it was a good way of getting women.
Being a priest?
Yeah.
Why would you say that's a little perverse?
I think it is.
Why would you think that that would be a good way of getting women?
Well,
a drummer,
thought,
I can understand. A
no,
priest,
I just thought
I don't get
I just thought, you know, priests were always surrounded by women. weren't the priests in your neighborhood surrounded by women? I thought you looked kind of attractive in your cassock, you know, and all those costumes. And I think the theatricality of the whole thing appealed to me. But the celibacy put me off.
Right, yeah. Right. So when did you wise up?
I wised up pretty quickly. I mean, I toyed with the idea, but it was only toying. A lot of my friends became monks, actually.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they still?
I think so, yeah.
Now, how did you react to the discipline of Catholic school?
It was a fairly disciplined school. I was in a school with almost 3,000 boys. So to keep order, I think it was a fairly brutal regime. You weren't allowed to step out of line without being hit very hard. But I rebelled a little bit. I was caned a lot. We were caned with a big stick.
On your knuckles or behind?
No, on the behind. And, I look back on it now. I don't mind it. I wouldn't have my children go through that, but I don't think it did me any harm, to be honest with you.
Did you ever cry when you were caned?
You don't cry from pain, you cry from rage. After the third or fourth one, it's rage because it hurts.
That's kind of like crying because of pain, isn't it?
No, it's different.
It's different.
Crying from pain is different. Crying from rage is worse, actually.
So was it hard to sit after a caning?
You didn't want to sit after a caning,
no. Now, what was your school uniform like?
It was kind of maroon, a maroon jacket, grey trousers, grey shirt, a maroon tie, usually raggy, you know, raggy trousers and elbows that were worn.
How did you feel about having to wear a uniform?
It kind of marked you out from the rest of the kids you'd been brought up with, working class kids that you would play with in the street. When at the age of 11, you're whisked off to this school. I have to wear a uniform. It kind of separated you.
In a good way or a bad way?
No, a bad way.
Well, did it mean that you were probably wimpier or something?
No, it meant I was ostracized, really. That we were sort of told that we were the cream. You know, we were the top 10% of intelligence in the country, and I don't think it was true. But that kind of separated us from other people. I didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew the value of school. I knew that I wanted to do as well as I could academically because that was a route out, a route away from where I was. I wasn't very happy where I was.
What didn't you like about where you were?
It seemed to be a sort of monochrome world. You know, it was kind of grey. I used to go to the movies with my brother on a Saturday and we'd see this technicolor world of Hollywood, you know, and I'd think, why isn't life like that here? So I wanted to escape to a technicolor world.
We're listening to an interview with Sting recorded last year. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Well, let's get back to the story of Sting, the early years. So we had established that you went to Catholic school. And when, I guess it was after college, you taught poetry in a convent school for a while. Do I have that right?
I taught poetry. I taught soccer. I taught music. I qualified as an English teacher.
Uh-huh.
And I taught in school for about 2 years. I trained for 3 years and taught for two. I enjoyed teaching, actually. I enjoyed the hurly-burly of the classroom. I enjoyed standing up in front of a classroom and imparting things. I'm not sure that I taught anybody anything. I think that what happens in a classroom is learning, you know. I think some learning went on. When I enjoyed a subject, I could express enthusiasm for it, and therefore hopefully the kids got that enthusiasm in an infectious kind of way. But when I wasn't interested, I don't think I could teach anything.
So was this a convent school?
It was. It was run by nuns. I was the only man on the staff.
Oh, this is perfect. This is like your fantasy come true almost.
Well, not quite. Not quite, no.
No. Well, it must be pretty strange to be a young man surrounded by women in the most non-sexual place that you could imagine.
Well, I got away with murder, actually. I was a musician at the time, and I was working very late at night in bands and sometimes having to go away for gigs. And so they just let me get away with it. You know, I was just said, look, I've got a gig tonight. Can I have the afternoon off? Or I got in late last night. Can I have the morning off?
So what was the band that you were moonlighting in?
I was in a lot of bands. I used to play in traditional jazz groups, actually, like Dixieland jazz groups.
And you played bass?
I played the bass, mainly with much older people than myself. And I learned jazz standards that way. I learned to read music that way. It was a strange education for a rock musician. I mean, most rock musicians learn Led Zeppelin songs, and I was learning 12th Street Rag.
So you were playing an upright bass?
I was playing an upright bass. But I was having a great time. I loved it. It didn't seem to be the route to rock stardom, though.
Is that what you wanted?
No, I wanted to be a muser. I wanted to be a musician. And this seemed to be the right way to go. Then I was in a big band. I played Count Basie arrangements, Neil Hefti arrangements, Duke Ellington arrangements. And I don't know, I think if I have a broad musical outlook now, it's because of the way I was educated musically. And that it wasn't just three chords in a garage, it was something else. Then I worked in theatres in the pit for musicals. I backed comedians, I backed striptease artists. I've just about done every musical job. I even played on a cruise ship.
So did you learn how to transpose and play in any key, depending on who you were backing?
Yeah, you'd learn how to busk. I mean, it's a phrase in England, you busk. They start a tune, and then they change the key at will, you know, and if they raise one finger, it's in the key of G. If they raise two, it's in the key of D. If they raise three fingers, it's in the key of A. If they put one finger down, it's in the key of F, and two fingers down is the key of B flat. I mean, you learn all these codes, and you learn all the I once backed Tiny Tim, actually.
Really?
And he could sing every standard, hundreds and hundreds of standards, one after the other, and that was a hell of a job.
So, no, what was the bridge between the work that you were doing and a rock and roll band?
I found a couple of people who were in this world with me, who were my age, and who had interest in playing jazz or rock and roll. And we formed a group in my hometown, and we used to play our own music in a pub. And we ended up with a residency. The band was called Last Exit. And I was the singer and the bass player, and we had a group that was very similar to the group I have at the moment, which is a four-piece group with drums, keyboards, bass, and guitar.
So how did you get an audition for The Police when the band was forming?
I was playing with this band called Last Exit at a local college, and a rock journalist that I knew who was local, he used to do local reviews of big bands. I just reviewed a band called Curved Air, and the drummer of Curved Air was Stuart Copeland. And after the gig, he said, "Why don't you come to this college and see this band Last Exit, because the singer is very interesting." He was talking about me. And I met Stuart afterwards, and, you know, we exchanged telephone numbers, and he said, "If you're ever in London, call me." So, you know, about 3 months later, I decided that I was going to go to London and seek my fortune. Stuart's was the only telephone number I had. I called him up. He was living in a squat in Mayfair. You know what a squat is?
It's basically a place you move into that's like an abandoned...
Yeah, and you don't pay any rent. Anyway, I moved in there. We started this band. He called it The Police. It was his group. He'd written these songs, and it was the time of sort of punk, you know, the Sex Pistols and Johnny Rotten and all that. Mm-hmm. And we started to play in this old loft and got a few gigs. And I really didn't think it was going to happen. I didn't think the music was serious enough. But I stuck with it. And we ended up with a guitarist called Andy Summers, who was that was the final group that ended up as The Police. And we made a record called Roxanne. The record company heard it. They liked it. They signed it. It was a moderate hit. And then we came to America. And we came without a record company, actually. We came just with our airfares and enough money to hire a bus, a little station wagon, actually. And we turned up at little gigs in places like Poughkeepsie and Syracuse, and three or four people would come to these gigs. And we built it up that way, slowly.
Roxanne really has a reggae influence. Had you been listening to a lot of reggae yourself?
I would contest that. A lot of people say it's reggae. It's not. It's a tango if you listen to it.
You think so?
It's a tango. I mean, I was
just listening to it again this morning and thinking, really reggae.
I was thinking that, I mean, I was very fond of Bob Marley at the time, so I was singing like Bob Marley. But the music actually is a tango.
Mm-hmm.
It's not reggae.
When you say you're singing like Bob Marley, were you trying to get some of his inflections also?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I was very influenced by Bob, and that's a clear influence. But the music itself isn't reggae.
Well, why don't we hear some of Roxanne, your first hit?
You'll hear it's a tango.
Okay. Listen closely. Now, Roxanne was actually banned by the BBC, wasn't it? Because the lyrics were about prostitution.
Oh, I think they were looking for an excuse not to play it. I mean,
why would they need an excuse not to play it? I mean, why would they not want to play it?
Because so many records come out, they're dying for an excuse to say, well, we can't even consider this one. But we made it. We made a big thing out of that. They banned us, you know. I don't think it was because of the subject matter. It's quite benign, really.
Now, this was a period when the police were getting started, when punk rock was also taking off. Did you want to be a part of that, or did you feel aesthetically distant from it?
Well, you know, I was a musician. I felt, you know, I paid my dues as a musician, and I felt punk was about people who just picked up guitars that month and made records, and the energy was something that I appreciated. Understood, and their anger was something that I really associated with, because I felt I'd been shut out of the music industry too. So I definitely felt a part of that. Well, the musical thing was not really my cup of tea, but I think it was a flag of convenience that we flew. I mean, I looked like I was part of the scene, even though I was a real musician, and so I just, you know, was expedient use of a fashion, if you like.
Now, how did it feel, too, to have a much kind of more pure, sweet voice in the era of punk, when people were actually shouting songs a lot, too?
Yeah, but they're only shouting because they couldn't sing. You know, I can do that as well. I think it's a choice that I make, actually.
What surprised you most about rock and roll success?
That success and happiness weren't the same thing. If anything, they seemed to be the opposite. I think some of the most successful periods in my life were the most unhappy. That was a good lesson to learn. It's a lesson that I take very seriously now. Success for me is to be happy and sane, not necessarily have millions of records sold or millions of Grammy nominations or whatever. That's not particularly wonderful. It's nice, but it's not happiness.
Remember you said as a kid you went to the movies and you wished you could live in that kind of Technicolor world. Mm-hmm. Did you ever end up feeling like you inhabited that kind of Technicolor world?
I don't remember.
Right. Okay. Too distracted by...
I was distracted. I mean, I'm glad I was quite old. I was 25 or 26 when all of this was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I'd been any younger, I'd probably been dead. But I managed to survive it, and I'm here today to tell the tale. But it was pretty wild. I mean, it was pretty meteoric. I mean, it was just everything is thrown at you, and nothing is encouraging you to grow up or be responsible.
It always seems like such a dangerous formula for somebody who's young.
I think it is. And, you know, you can be 19 and be on top of the world, and then the next year you're at the bottom of the heap, and that's an impossible tragedy. You can't really recover from that.
You've had a parallel acting career, which began, I think, with Quadrophenia. Was that your first film?
That was the second film I made, but I fell into films by accident. I had no ambition to be an actor. I never trained as an actor. I was never even in a school play. I just happened to be in the right place at the right time with the right haircut.
Of the films of yours that I've seen, my favorite performance is in Stormy Weather. Stormy Monday. Which Mike Figgis directed, who also directed Leaving Las Vegas. And you're a kind of corrupt, pretty mean club owner.
Oh, I thought I was rather nice, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was set in Newcastle, which is the hometown
That's where you grew up.
Of both Mike Figgis and myself. And
did that have anything to do with you meeting?
Oh, absolutely. He wanted someone who knew that scene. That club scene was very similar to my musical background. I used to play in clubs like that. And so he knew that and cast me because of that. And I actually played my brother in that. My brother owns a club in Newcastle.
Really?
Yeah.
What kind of music does he have?
He has, you know, jazz and rock and roll and folk music.
Gee, does he impose on you to... to come and play?
No, he doesn't. But he recognized himself in the movie. Just quite funny.
That was Sting, recorded last year. He's starring in the new movie Gentlemen Don't Eat Poets. And tomorrow night, he hosts Saturday Night Live. Coming up, a review of the new movie Love Jones. This is Fresh Air.